Hence you will remember that we stated that the lower strata, in point of position, of the spiritual spheres, immediately interpenetrate this earth. We pointed to the fact that this chamber, by way of illustration, might be represented as full of spiritual spheres. Are you not therefore surrounded by the spirit world and its inhabitants? In the change called death, the spirit, in fact, does not quit this earth at all, until through the various stages of progression it passes from the earthly spheres into higher and more distant ones. Hades is here, the mid-region where dwell the souls of men during their second sphere of eternal existence is within this natural earth of yours. The actual mutual relationship which spirit and matter sustains, is intensified moreover by those ties of kind, affection, and soul affinities, which it belongs to consciousness to remember forever. If you preserve in the disintegration of the material form the memory of earth, its joys, its sorrows, but above all of its affections, how do you suppose that those who have lived and loved in your midst can pass to a sphere which they find to be progressive and state, and yet fail to carry with them those affections which are the divinest parts of the soul, or retain no memory of those with whom they have lived in ties of sweetest companionship on earth? If, indeed, the spirit still loves beyond the grave, that spirit must also still love, and for the expression of that love there must in the spheres beyond this be means of action, and for that action an adequate mode of manifestation. What think you would be the paradise of the mother, or the heaven of the father, if, themselves removed from the sphere of human necessities, but remembering all the struggle and care they entail upon the precious ones who still remain subject to them, they were deprived of some mode of ministration and of some method of continuing the manifestations of their undying love? O tell us of no heaven, speak not to the heart of love, or to the soul of affection, of any paradise or place of rest, which is not most surely to the place of love. As the religionist, what evidence he has that his God and Father walks the earth, that here in the midst of his joys and sorrows the infinite one who has dispensed them all, takes cognizance of all? What evidence can he render us of his assertion? He answers, the traditions of my fathers, and the witness of my own soul. Even so have we the vast array of spiritual manifestations which every age informs us of, which this age confirms, and the witness alike of our souls and our senses. There are links of consciousness which connect us with the souls we love, that give us the assurance that if there is a life beyond the grave, that life has gathered up all of beauty that made the soul within us divine. And as the most beautiful blossoms of the soul are its affections, so if these expand not beyond the grave into a greater and more beautiful ministry of love than even this earth can exhibit, there is no paradise, there is no heaven, and immortality and progression are fictitious. Addresses by E.H.B. 33. Question 3. It is asserted that the phenomena of the Bible and of modern spiritualism are identical in kind and differ only in degree. If this be so, why should the former, that is the Bible phenomena, be regarded as the direct teaching of the Great Spirit, and accepted as authoritative, and the latter not so? Answer. We recommend your querist to address himself to those who claim the special authority of the older revelation. No such claim is made in this chamber, and therefore we should be compelled to beg the question ere we answered it. As we present from this rostrum the affirmative only of your question, should you not suggest it to those who deny our truth? Ask your soul's teachers to respond to you. Ask those whom you pay, educate, sustain, and maintain in your midst, for the express purpose of resolving such points of doctrine as this. We say there is neither difference in degree, kind, quality, nor origin between any spiritual manifestation of any age, except in the mode of its representation, in the technical phraseology wherein it is recorded, or in some merely local mode of making the record. Examine the facts of the phenomena of spiritualism in every age, and you will find that they resolve themselves into all the simple classifications rendered familiar to you at the modern spirit circle. We find that the element of magnetism, of which we have discoursed so largely, is the force by which the phenomena are made. The soul or spirit within man, and the soul which has already become enfranchised from matter, are the agents, while the scientific assimilation of the spiritual body of the disembodied and of the embodied souls, in the form of magnetic rapport, are the means by which the entire phenomena are produced. magnetism and psychology are the two great pillars that support the temple of modern spiritualism. Enter within its gates, and you will find there are differences of administration, but the same spirit. We should be happy to pass over this query to any of the churches of your city, and not alone to place it in the hands of your elected teachers, but to compel them to render an answer, and to demonstrate proofs of that answer, coherent with fact, law, science, reason, and religion, and to render it to as publicly as we are ready to render ours. Question 4. Is spirit developed along with the human body, or does it enter it fully formed? And at what period? Answer: the question requires some other explanation than belongs to the mere subject of the birth or formation of the embryo. We have said in a former address, to which we must again refer, that spirit and matter have ever been exhibited together in all the various records that man, historically, traditionally or scientifically, can discover of creation. Wheresoever matter has been exhibited, the direct evidence of spirit is manifest in the intelligence of laws that govern matter. These laws always manifest wisdom, power, addresses by EHB 34, and goodness, and these, the most divine attributes of intelligence, are invariably displayed in the forms of matter, in the illimitable beauty, order and consecutiveness that control all laws, in the supreme and boundless power that is manifested through them, and in their eternal repetition and infinity. In all representations of material forms, spirit is as immanent in the handwriting on the wall of the temple of being, as if we beheld it face to face, embodied in our presence. What shall we say then of those highly sublimated atoms of matter, those monads, which exist first in the structureless cell from which the embryo of humanity no less than that of all animated life commences? We examine that microscopic cell, and we first perceive that it is structureless, from the fact that even in the most searching investigation no evidence is there of aught but homogeneous matter. Yet in the progress of growth from this unpromising molecule, we find it elaborated into a multitude of other cells, within each of which is the principle of life, growth, and all the forms of motion necessary for its development into an aggregated mass of heterogeneous matter. At this stage, a fresh set of functions become manifest, enabling the embryo to secrete these in various organs, and various tissues, substances and qualities of matter. I do not design in this place to enlarge on these processes of growth which are constantly expanding up to the point when there is the manifestation of a brain. From this period of development we claim that there is the evidence of individualized spirit. We affirm this because we perceive that the nervous system is the apparatus arranged for the exhibition of spirit, and that the brain is the great originator or generator of the nervous system. We cannot separate one single atom of being from a connection with the vast totality which we call God, or cut it off from the existence of the great and infinite spirit, whose laws are written in the least as in the great forms of being. Hence we cannot point to the exact period when the spirit of the infinite becomes repeated in his image, and manifests itself in a human soul, except to note the period when, by the development of a brain in the embryo and the formation of a nervous system, that spirit can exhibit itself in the attribute of will. From this point, and from this point alone, are we enabled to draw the line of demarcation between the exhibition of spirit and matter in embryotic forms. And yet, beyond this point we may claim that all matter exhibits spirit, that all spirit requires matter for its exhibition. It is merely a question, then, of individualized spirit. This we believe first becomes an identity from the point when matter exhibits itself, as we have stated in the formation of a brain and of its ramification into a nervous system. Question 5. Have animals spirit? If not, what is the nature of their life, and how is it they have so many of the feelings, affections, passions, and mental endowments of men? Answer: we answer you now briefly, because the question has been considered fully within the last few days. We will therefore only remind you, that the exhibition of intelligence in the animal creation is merely partial and fragmentary, that whatsoever of wonder and strangeness, even in the form of intellectual manifestation, appears in the animal kingdom, as in the case of the mole, that works his way in the darkness in certain invariable directions, as if guided by the points of the compass, in addresses by EHB 35, the case of the beaver, who displays an extraordinary ingenuity in the erection of his dwelling, and in the construction of the dam, as would do honor to an instructed engineer, in the work of the geometrical ant, and of the mathematical bee, in all these and in every other creature's wonderful evidence of special instinctive intelligence, there is a tendency in the form of all these creatures to outwork precisely the character of the intelligence, which is observed in them. Were you to separate them from the soil in which you find them habitually living, were you to place them in conditions strange to them, they would still carry out the peculiar tendencies of their forms in none other. I believe that the entire of the animal world is a vast panorama, in which nature, by the ordering of the infinite mind, has represented the various fragments, both of form and intellectual life, which are afterwards bound up in the grand compendium and microcosm of all creation, man. I believe that the existence of many of these primal and experimental creatures of nature's wondrous schoolhouse, antedate the appearance of man on this globe. I believe that their organism, or rather that the progression of matter in their organisms, is a species of preparation for the finer and more sublimated atoms that compose man, and hence I believe that all things are both prophetic and preparatory for the life of man. I believe that in eternity the perfect alone is preserved. I believe that one of those deeply philosophical sentences that from time to time are strewed like gems of spiritual light throughout the scriptures of the Jews is found in the passage that the wages of sin is death, and the gift of God is eternal life. Sin is naught but partial good. Sin is naught but the attempt of a finite being to represent the supernal ideas of the infinite, broken and marred by imperfect manifestation. When you consider the quality and nature of sin, you will find it is either an excess or a deficit of some beneficent virtue which, when practiced within the boundary of law, reduces the excess called evil to good and blessing. For instance, consider the various crimes that man is guilty of, and you will find they either proceed from an excess of love which, when regulated and balanced in due equilibrium between himself and his neighbor, is the law of self-preservation and justice. But, if carried to excess in either direction, becomes selfishness or prodigality, and thus from sin results its sequence, in discord, hate, disease, and death, so that sin is imperfection, pain its teacher, and death or change its last and inevitable penalty. But even sin is transitory, so transitory as that when we pass the grave of the criminal, we seldom recall the crimes of his earth life with half as much of enmity, as of regret and tender pity. We find that death has paid the penalty of his sin. We feel, even if we do not know it absolutely, that he is changed, lives in progress, and our own appreciation of his guilt is modified by this nameless consciousness that the imperfect dies, but the gift of God, the good and perfect, lives forever. And it is this law of preservation for the perfect only, which bestows immortality on the soul of man, but denies it to the semi-perfect fragments of spiritual life incarnate in the forms of animals. True, their spirits are preserved for a period, the spiritual part or essence which manifests itself in will, and intelligence, is preserved in the spheres that encircle and zone this planet, but not beyond it. All the lower spheres beneath this planet, and their imperfect representations of human life, partake so largely of animal characteristics that they scarcely exhibit the human form at all. Throughout the spirit spheres, the creatures that have ministered to our use still continue their relations to our spirits, so long as these remain in spheres of animal love, proclivities, and passions. Hence, as I have said, the spirit of animals are preserved in the earth spheres, but not beyond. And the destiny of the spiritual part of these creatures is to compose addresses by EHB 36, the grand totality of forces which make up some higher and superior world with its spirit spheres. Question 6. Will you indicate the nature of the dangers, if any, attending the cultivation of mediumship, and how any such may be guarded against? Answer. Every human organism possesses the force which constitutes mediumship. I have said that every human being is a medium, and it belongs to the present question to represent in what sense. There is an inevitable and direct relation between the highest and the lowest of all forms and all beings in creation, and this direct relationship produces a mode of mutual influence and spiritual impression between all creatures, which is inspiration. It is the chain of thought which permeates all spheres and worlds, and wherever receptive beings are found, inspiration connects them, the lowest with the highest. Each creature receives its appropriate share of inspiration, and it is such as his organism and process of development enables him to receive. Thus each living being is in this sense a medium for an influence from some other being, whether this can manifest itself in external phenomena or not, is not now the question. Whether it can be cultivated is the point to which we would call your attention, and to this we reply, yes. As all inspiration is regulated and meted out to every creature by the measure of their receptivity, so whatsoever improves the intellect refines the understanding, or helps to aid the aspiration of the spirit to higher and grander spheres than those of earth. All these constitute the direct and progressive stages of receptivity by which our inspiration may be cultivated. I separate this kind of mediumship from the question of mere external phenomena. This is produced wholly through the physical organism and the amount of magnetism and electricity given off by the system. Electricity is the finer and more sublimated pole of the magnetic battery within us, magnetism is the coarser and grosser, and though it is one and the same substance, yet, as exhibiting polarity, we may separate them and call them electricity and magnetism. Those persons who possess either of these forces in excess, both being one force but exhibiting themselves in a dual mode, and give it off in such abundance as to enable spirits to form a battery with them, are called spirit mediums. Either of these exhibitions may be cultivated by placing yourselves in magnetic relations with each other, as in spirit circles, or by determining the nervous forces in the direction of thought of certain organs of the brain, by aspiration, prayer, and contemplation of spiritual subjects. Thus, when you sit in circles, or alone, waiting for the manifestation of the spirit, all your nervous force is determined in the direction of the peculiar thought which is fastened upon the spirit world, and therefore in the circle, or in the attitude of waiting for the spirit, you may be sure you are in rapport with the spirit world, even if your organism fails to furnish the requisite force of magnetism to produce the evidence of its presence by phenomena. The dangers that grow out of these exercises are the possibilities of parting with too much magnetism, or of sending forth too great a charge of electricity in the determination of the nervous force, and the loss that is sustained is calculated sometimes to derange either the organs of the brain or of the physical system, and hence deterioration of health or of addresses by EHB 37. The equilibrium which we call sanity may possibly ensure. But remember that if these dangers exist in the attempt to cultivate the relationship between the spiritual and natural world, God never leaves himself without a witness of warning and instruction, alike in your senses, hearts, consciences and understandings. The voice of conscience dictates to you right and wrong, the emotions of your heart regulate your affections, and the word is equally potent that comes to your understanding. If your or the equilibrium of your mind suffer, be sure that kind nature is herself less owning you to desist from your exertions. If those nameless antipathies and repulsions that sometimes prevail at the spirit circle are disregarded, how shall the spirit speak to the outward ear if the interior is blunt and deaf? The external senses speak through the understanding, the spirit through feeling and emotion. These are the warnings whose failures and observances are to teach you to wend your way through the new and seemingly mysterious science of spiritualism. There is no royal road to learning, or to the language of the heart and conscience in morals and affections, and why should there be in this new mental science, which you are called upon to spell out for yourselves through mental monitions? Be sure that the warnings of the spirit which have been referred to, are discoverable in feeling, nervous sensibility, or the various phases of spiritual perception that arise at the spirit circle. Our spirits are wiser than we deem, and their impressions are the voice of a spirit speaking to the natural man with a wisdom beyond the natural only. The dangers of the spirit circle arise only when they manifest themselves as danger or direct evils. Heed the voices of warning of which I have spoken, be your own sentinels at the spirit circle. Let your conscience be present and warn you back from one single attempt of spirit, embodied or disembodied, to trench upon the law of right. The voice of conscience is as potent at the spirit circle if you will heed it as in the city streets, or in the midst of embodied souls. Let your hearts plead with you in the name of affection, in the name of those holy ties of kindred which God Himself has knit around your hearts, to communicate with the precious dead when they come to you at the spirit circle, as readily as you would do if father, mother, brother, sister, or friend stood before you in the embodied form of mortality. Let none step between you and the teachings of your heart. Wheresoever father, mother, or friend are, and still living, your heart has the right to go out and search for them. It has the right to penetrate into all mysteries of space which can bring you a response from those whom God has taught you to love, and let the voice of your understanding be the third monitor to warn you of the dangers of the spirit circle where they exist. Be sure that wheresoever health, or equilibrium of mind is injured, your understanding clearly points the way of retreat. Use your judgment at the spirit circle, rend the veil of mystery in which you envelope the subject and treat it as it deserves, as a revelation to humanity which does not need any other supernatural revelation to explain it, than the understanding which God Himself has given you. Deal with the dangers of modern spiritualism after this fashion, and you will find that instead of the phantom you fear, you are grasping the substance of life in attempting to explore the science of spiritualism. There are no real dangers in the spirit circle but such as grow out of the very same excesses which in morals we call sin, in science ignorance, and in spirit communion too much fanaticism, or skepticism, or an attempt to transmute the simply natural into the abnormal supernatural. Addresses by E.H.B. 38. Question 7. Will you explain the meaning of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the tree of life? Answer. Remember that the earliest mode of writing among the ancients was by pictures and symbols. If you attempt to comprehend the various meanings symbolized in picture writing, you will arrive at the conclusion that there is nearly as much unity in man's earliest attempts to record his thoughts as there is now in alphabetical signs. The universal significance amongst Oriental nations of the story of creation was this: a tree represented life, its fruit knowledge, a garden the earth, beauty and peace the conditions of man's first infantile state of being, a serpent signified the craft and subtlety of intellect, tempting the human soul to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Man's inquisitive intellect eats the fruit, attains to the knowledge, and finds he has forfeited his Eden of unconscious though ignorant innocence. He pays the penalty of becoming informed of the difference between good and evil by recognizing that with his newly acquired wisdom he is a responsible being. He comes restless for more knowledge, goes forth into the world still paying the penalty of intellect by being compelled to outwork it, and in the toil and labor of a self-reliant life that ensues, he finds he has left his paradise, learns to appreciate life's struggles and realizes the curse or antagonism of matter which is associated with his spirit, and by whose movings he finds that there is this antagonistic power as constantly drawing him downwards, as God, the infinite, is drawing him up from matter to spirit. In a word, with the knowledge of good and evil, he realizes that life's destiny is labor and pain. The whole history of man's exodus from the state of innocence, which is still to the child paradise though to the adult ignorance, still to the savage paradise, in the absence of the cares, pains and penalties that grow out of knowledge. The exodus of man in the earliest period of human history is thus simply represented in picture writing, or that symbolical oriental mode in which the most early people of earth recorded their thoughts. We now comprehend the true purposes of this beautiful allegorical mode of representing the first condition of humanity, that came from the hands of our God perfect as our little children are perfect, because in their innocence and unconsciousness of life, they have not yet sinned, because they have not eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Nevertheless, if we would return to our Creator with the knowledge as well as the innocence which constitutes divine love and wisdom, the day must come when man must eat of the fruit of the tree, and like our children go forth from the paradise of home and innocence, and bear earth's pains and penalties, because they please the intellect to appreciate that their destiny is the warfare of good and evil. And behold, the angel of progression stands with a sword of adversity and pain at the door of our paradise and warns us onward, compelling us to use the knowledge we have gained in constant effort, labor and spiritual warfare, so that we may return again through the discipline of life and its mighty struggles back to the paradise we have quitted, not as we left it, ignorant and without knowledge, but innocent through the love acquired by wisdom, instructed in knowledge through the teachings gained by experience. This we believe to be the design which the ancients intended to represent through the allegory of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of, addresses by EHB 39, good and evil, and the universal symbol of intellect and immortality represented in the east by a serpent. Question 8. Physicians and physiologists call the wonderful function of healing, in the restoration of animal or vegetable bodies which are wounded or sick, the vis medicatrix. What is this healing property? Is it a distinct power? Is it of, or does it afford any analogy to, any restrictive economy by which the disordered condition of the soul is to be supernaturally regenerated? Answer: the question involves some points to which we must take exception. For instance, we could not render our response comprehensible to you were we to speak of whatsoever the physicians may denominate as the life principle, unless we call it by the name of its nearest approximate element, namely, magnetism. We believe that human structures are made up of the atoms of matter which have become sublimed in infinitely varied organisms below man, and that all these bring in the grand assemblage of elements found in man, all the peculiar magnetic forces that belong to them, the concentration of which is the life principle in man. Now, in the act of what is called healing by touch or magnetism, the whole action is simple, and requires no peculiar and incomprehensible phrases to define it. It is merely the projection of the life principle from one healthful body to another less physically strong and well balanced. All disease has its origin in the imponderable forces of life. Wheresoever the life currents flow equally and freely through the system, they produce an equilibrium which we call health. The disturbance of these life currents, therefore, is the true source of disease, and wheresoever there is a debility in the flow of the magnetic life, there is decay. Where there is undue stimulant and excitement, there is fever, and these are the two proximate causes of all disease, and every external evidence of disease surely originates from foregone causes, of course, in one or other of these states of the vital currents of the human system. Now, the action of cure is to restore an equilibrium in the life currents. The entire of the cures effected by magnetism proceed on this principle. The mode of cure practiced by the allopathist is to introduce foreign substances into the system, and by these to produce a radical change, or, in other words, to create a new disease which conquers the original one, and this they call the restoration of health. The action of every drug is medicinal, and its function is so to disturb the system as to produce disease in the healthful subject and a fresh disease in the sick. By this latter process it purposes to achieve a conquest over the original complaint, and that even at the cost of introducing a new one, for in almost every instance the drug leaves foreign conditions in the system, which deranges its integrity and remains to the latest period of life. And the difference between allopathy and homeopathy, and we are now speaking of facts and principles, not of personalities, the difference between the mode of treatment in the allopathist and homeopathist is but a difference of degree. Some of the principles vary, because the first of those claimed by the homeopathist is that like cures like addresses by EHB 40, while the allopathist demands no condition of similitude between the disease and the drug disease. Still with the homeopathist the drug disease must be introduced into the system, by way of destroying one demon by the presence of a stronger than that which is already there, but it is claimed that in its infinitesimal size the homeopathic drug demon is too petty to effect harm, although it is assumed to be potent enough to do good. We must confess to a want of faith in this mode of argument, and fear that the potency works both ways, and whilst it quenches one disease leaves another in its place. In one system then we introduce the seven demons into the mansion. In the other, after our house is swept and garnished, we introduce one who is more potent than the whole seven put together. Now supposing, instead of either of these systems, that we can introduce that which is always healthful, the life itself, that instead of dealing with the effect we touch the cause, instead of legislating for the disease, we attack the very source, and restore the equilibrium, the lack of which originated the disease? and by projecting life within the system, permit that life to do its own normal work, and conquer the disease for itself.